Welcome to The Rest of History, a new history podcast with a new audience in mind. I'm Lauren.
I'm Sam.
And today, Sam is going to tell us a story that hasn't gotten enough attention in mainstream history. Sam, what are we learning about today?
Lauren, as always, I am so glad you asked. Today, we are going to be talking about female husbands.
Not everybody was in our seminar class last semester, so for the, you know, for the viewers, for the fans at home, Sam, you want to tell us what exactly a female husband is?
Yeah, so for everyone else who doesn't know about my absolute obsession with female husbands, an artificial obsession that has only maybe started out of a joke and has only progressed.
But is nevertheless important.
Oh, of course, of course. The actual definition of what a female husband is has definitely shifted throughout time. It has meant many, many different things. So the trope of the female husband, you can see it throughout literature. Like, the Atlantic world is very much obsessed with female husband stories. The situations I'm going to tell you about definitely came under, you know, similar exaggerations, where they take these stories, the press takes these stories of these people and spins it, makes them a little kooky, makes them a little crazy, you know, and
it's hard to believe, actually, that people that are not involved would try to objectify women's lives.
What?
That is brand new information.
Mm-hmm. And maybe a good place to start is just generally talking about cross-dressing throughout history, right?
Sure.
The reason I was talking about before how female husbands go through a lot of different definitions is because women performing as men is not a new thing now, and it wasn't a new thing in the time period we are going to be discussing, which was the 18th century. One of the more interesting places we see it within U.S. history education, like mainstream history education, is discussions about Robert Shurtleff.
I'll fully cop to not knowing who that is.
I didn't either, but apparently a lot of people do. I was like, who? But when we discussed this book within my U.S. Colloquial 1 class, people were like, oh yeah, learned about her in school. And basically Robert Shurtleff took their brother's clothes, joined the Continental Army, and became like a spy badass and like brought guns blazing, fuck shit up.
Yeah, this sounds familiar to somebody who's born of the 90s and was raised on animated Disney films. She's very much getting Mulan. So Fa Mulan, I mean, that's an ancient story. There's, mm-hmm. you know, there's representation of people performing as different genders than other people would expect of them everywhere. And that's, totally. I mean, first of all, let me clarify this. All gender is a performance, quite frankly, because we're not born...
Snap, snap, snap.
We're not born out of the womb with particular fashion sense in mind, understanding that certain colors are more like the gender that we feel. Those things are taught to us, and if you don't think that they are, ask your parents and grandparents what kind of things they dressed you in and what kind of things they maybe dress your opposite gender or sex siblings in. They're not inherent. They're not from nature.
This performance of gender, like Lauren mentioned, everybody does it, right? Every once in a while, you'll even see those images of FDR as a baby roll around on social media where he's wearing like a cute little dress, because all of this is made up, right? Societal norms made up. I do want to emphasize the fact that Black enslaved women often, you know, performed in cross-dressing in order to escape plantations, you know, Underground Railroad, make it to Canada, etc., etc. So it's not even a thing that is specific to the experience of white women.
So if anybody's getting heated in the comments, first of all, you're probably listening to the wrong podcast.
Definitely.
I might suggest for you a certain person whose name rhymes with Schmo Schmogen.
The experience.
The experience. This is not that. We're here to learn in an open-minded way, and Sam, I'm very, very excited to hear about what makes female husbands so compelling.
I find female husbands to be extremely interesting. For one, scholarship on female husbands is so important because for whatever reason, out of the last few decades, there's this whole narrative that LGBTQ plus people are like a new thing, that it's like a fad, right? And I think you see it a lot in terms of transgender discourse, where you'll have politicians or, you know, just like a soccer mom down the street being like, oh, well, I didn't know any transgender people. It's fake. It's a fad.
Yeah. Right? Recently been a statistic that's been passed around a lot on social media. And I mean, weaponized by people who just aren't sympathetic. They're essentially what they're doing is complaining because they've noticed that Gen Z has a higher proportion of their population, of their demographic, that identifies as part of the LGBTQ plus community. And, you know, people are saying that they're doing it for attention or mm-hmm. there's something wrong. No, it's actually, as we as a society generally move, and I'm using generally very loosely here because I want to acknowledge that there's obviously a very large section of the American public right now that is just completely moving backwards on this. As more people become educated and more accepting, inclusive, more understanding, more sympathetic, how interesting is it that more people would feel comfortable sharing that about themselves?
Right.
No kidding. I mean, if I tell you I don't like people with freckles, you're probably not going to, you know, hang out around me, be around me, be near me with your freckles out on display. First of all, that would be complete hypocrisy. I am one pasty bitch and I live and breathe freckles. I find new ones on my body every damn day. But, I mean, you're probably going to take steps to conceal that. And that's a very silly way of demonstrating. I mean, if you have been told that part of you isn't acceptable, you're probably not going to showcase that. And more people feel comfortable identifying as something if it's acceptable to the wider public.
Right.
No shit, Sherlock. Like, we've been new.
Exactly. And I think that's why scholarship on female husbands is so important. Because similar to like George Chauncey's Gay New York, which is a fabulous book, by the way, it's all about demonstrating that gay people existed before Stonewall, before the 1960s sexual revolution, right? Like people of the LGBTQ plus community existed. Wow. Completely hard to fathom. Like what?
Yeah. Even though we totally knew about that in ancient Greece, we were just like, no.
Yes.
I mean, also a big part of that is just, you know, certain government officials, Ronald Reagan, I mean, basically killed off an entire age group of LGBTQ elders that would be around today and would have their histories to share if it were not for the fact that they have basically been told by their government, your health is not a priority to us, and therefore aren't around to share those stories. So as this community becomes stronger in numbers and stronger in safety, it then naturally follows that, hey, maybe we feel safe to tell our stories.
With that, female husbands present an interesting opportunity to be able to explore the life of somebody who didn't necessarily fit into traditional understandings of woman and man. And we also get a great glimpse into how gender was perceived in mid-18th century England at the time these stories are going to take place. A lot of the literature that has been written on female husbands is produced at a very non-coincidental time, right? So you have a lot of it coming out of marriage equality. You have a lot of it coming out of like the 1960s and so on and so forth. But to quickly just go through how historians' perceptions of female husbands have changed, first, female husbands were basically just viewed as women who cross-dressed in order to have financial freedom, right? Like freedom of mobility, freedom to pursue economic opportunities. From there, we have historians thinking about female husbands more as women who cross-dressed in order to pursue relationships with other women. And then finally, where we are today, female husbands have been considered through a transgender lens. This idea that perhaps female husbands felt like men, right? They wanted to choose to live like men, be perceived as men. And that's not to say that any of the other options are wrong, because that's not the case. Female husbands were not a monolithic group. as we described previously, women performed gender in numerous different ways. Women cross-dressed for numerous reasons, and a lot of them were perceived as female husbands anyways. So that's not to say that any scholarship is necessarily wrong, but it's about looking at it with a more nuanced lens. Maybe some people did feel like men and performed male gender, like, for that reason.
As I'm thinking about those kind of three different waves there, it strikes me that as we go through the historiological change, it gets closer towards the individual. So you kind of start with, you know, how does the world see this concept? And then it's how are they perceived in their world by the relationships, by the people they know? You know, how are they presented to their, you know, place in society? And then it's how do they feel as individuals, which I think allows actually for greater diversity too. And recognizing exactly as you said, like, no group truly is monolithic. I mean, every individual on Earth has a completely different experience and different life. So, hey, how about that? Maybe it's a nuanced thing, and maybe gender binary is bullshit.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think history in general is also moving in that direction, right? We're seeing more work focused on the individual. Something I do want to get into again before we start the story, because this is a complicated topic, right? There is so much political discourse now around discussions about LGBTQ plus peoples, what language to use, things like that. And of course, with so many things, there is a danger of applying modern definitions to past people. In the case of female husbands, we are going to be looking at these individuals through a transgender lens, but people living in mid-18th century England would not have necessarily perceived themselves to be transgender because that concept didn't exist, right? Like, it would not have been a thing.
Like, from a lexicographical sense, like, that word had not been devised.
Yeah, so surely people might have felt that way, sure. But they did not have the language that we have today to deconstruct that, to express it to other people, to express it to themselves, maybe even. And taking that a step further, even if they did, we wouldn't have those sources. A lot of the times, family members after death would have been ashamed, would have burned letters, anything really that would have given us as historians a better glimpse into all of this.
And if you're thinking, no way did that happen, I mean, think about how many people you've heard family stories of like, your spinster aunt and her roommate.
Oh yeah.
families are weird. Families are weird concepts in general.
We do weird things. They were roommates.
Oh my god, they were roommates. Keeping up with the Robinsons, keeping up with the Kardashians, if you're from, you know, this side of the century, that's not a new concept. People feel perceived by others in society, and people do things to adjust how they are perceived, and that definitely was and is, frankly, still a thing people do.
One more thing to hit on. Proper pronoun use when talking about female husbands. There is no right answer to this. I'm going to take a page out of Jen Mannion's book. She wrote Female Husbands, A Trans History. A great read. Recommend it. 10 out of 10.
We'll pop that on the website. Show notes.
Yeah. Yep. She decides to refer to female husbands using they, them pronouns because we don't know what they would have identified themselves, right? We don't know if they would have preferred he, him, or she, her. That being said, other historians do bounce between the two depending on what female husbands decide to present themselves as. Jen Mannion has a lot to say about pronouns. Okay. She identifies she, her, or they, them. That being said, she has written a lot about the pronoun go-around, is what she calls it, and how that can be very harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And Jen also is just like, call me by my name. Like,
call me what you want. Call me what you need.
Precisely. So Jen is like, call me by my name. Here are my pronouns, because, you know, we are discussing Jen.
Right. The third person does exist.
Can make it a little complicated, but ultimately, yes, Mannion goes by either she, her, or they, them.
Okay, so is Jen making that point to say that these female husbands were not asked what kind of pronouns they were preferred. Like, that was not a societal thing that they were not asked what their preferred pronouns, because it was, you were assigned these at birth and that's it, point blank period.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And I think from an author's point of view, she argues it has to do with readability, where she doesn't want the reader to be so bogged down in the switching between pronouns, especially because there are other characters within these stories. And also she doesn't want to discredit or delegitimize the identity that female husbands felt for themselves. And because we don't know that, we don't want to self-impose our modern perceptions onto them. So she takes they, them to be the most inclusive route when discussing female husbands. And I do think that that's the best option for these stories where we don't fully know the truth. But of course, I will take precedence in referring to female husbands by their first name over their pronouns when possible. Another term we could be using a lot in this discussion is the idea of transing gender. So like transgender.
But, I've heard of it.
Yes, but with the ing at the end, sure. Right? So transing gender. Jen Mannion comes up with this term, and it describes a more active process. To say that someone transed or was transing gender signified this process without claiming to understand what it meant to that particular person.
Okay, so they're describing it more as a verb or a process and less as a noun or an end destination or a correct checkbox to tick.
Yeah, it's all about presenting female husbands as going through this like ever-evolving relationship with gender rather than shifting between male and female. Female husbands were actively switching oftentimes between gender performance. It can be hard to wrap your brain around at first, but I'm sure as we unfold the coming stories, everything will be illuminated.
I'm ready. Shine your light.
All of that to say, today I was thinking I would tell you two stories. One of a female husband and another of a woman who loved one.
Cue Carole King, The Spy Who Loved Me.
Ooh, good choice, good choice. Let's go. To start, I thought we would talk about Charles Hamilton. Ever heard about Charles Hamilton?
I've heard of Alexander Hamilton.
Not the same person.
Damn it. Then I'm starting from scratch here.
I started from scratch, like, a semester ago.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, I was born a baby. Yeah, no, we're using different definitions here, and you know what? Same process.
Yeah, we're getting there, getting there. So, Charles Hamilton is often considered to be the first female husband. But again, as we mentioned, definitions change a lot. So the first female husband documented under this new definition.
You're gonna hate me. I just thought of the absolute most terrible portmanteau, but if you're the first female husband, are you a transsetter? So not a trendsetter, but a transsetter?
We're gonna keep going.
Damn it.
If you need to take a minute outside, that's perfectly fine.
I thought that was so funny.
It was clever. Yes. It was very clever. I'll give it to you.
I'm very sleep deprived. Whatever happens with me in this episode, a couple grains of salt would appreciate it. I'm functioning.
She's surviving.
That is arguable.
Back to Charles.
Putting that train back in the station.
Yeah, so Charles Hamilton was born Mary Hamilton in Somerset, England. Yeah.
Southwest side.
But they spent the majority of their life in Scotland, living their best life, haggis and whatnot, with their parents, William and Mary Hamilton. There are so many Marys in this story. I'm going to apologize ahead of time. We have like four or five Marys. I will try my best to keep us on top of the Mary situation, but feel free to clarify it. And around the age of 14, and apparently without any sort of stated reason that has survived, that is, Hamilton took their brother's clothes and left home and started presenting as male from that point on.
Cool.
Love it. So after leaving home, Hamilton is having a great time in Scotland, basically secures two apprenticeships with two different mountebanks.
What on God's green earth is a mountebank?
I am so glad you asked, because I was right about to ask you, do you know what a mountebank is?
I know it in the context of a single line from Sweeney Todd. He lays 5 pounds that he can shave any cheek better than any street mountebank, referring to one Signore Pirelli. So I'm guessing it's like an entrepreneur of sorts, somebody that kind of like peddles their way. Am I on somewhat of the right track?
Yeah, no, you definitely are. So they are also known as quack doctors. So a mountebank would run around the countryside, whatnot, to go to different towns and peddle different ointments, different medications.
Snake oil.
Yes, very much that. But people trusted them, right?
Yes.
For the most part.
You know, the way that people still think that you should take medicine for horses to cure COVID.
Oh, I love a good ivermectin moment. Tasty.
Tasty. Personally enjoyed injecting bleach into my veins. That's why I'm so pasty. That's why I wear so much sunscreen, because I had bleach injected into my veins.
I wouldn't say it was as dangerous as all of that, right? They weren't necessarily prescribing injecting bleach.
But, I mean, Signore Pirelli is peddling a hair growth potion, and Sweeney Todd rightfully calls him on it and says this is nothing more than an errand fraud. It's a concoction of piss and ink.
Exactly. So they definitely didn't have medical training as you would expect from like the College of Surgeons and whatnot. But for the most part, people trusted them. They peddled ointment, we discussed, lived their best lives. As a profession at this point, from what I gather, like some people love it, some people hate it. Really depends on the mountebank you come in contact with.
Sure.
Because some of them, like, it just was effective home remedies and some of them sucked. So at this point, Hamilton secures these apprenticeships with a Dr. Edward Green and then later on a Dr. Finley Green. Have no idea if these two are related, but Dr. Edward Green is a very well-known mountebank. There's like a lot of writing on him traveling through Scotland. Hamilton, like many other people who are pursuing apprenticeships in the midst of their apprenticeship, they're gaining a lot of knowledge in the trade. Scholars make argument that Hamilton's also gaining knowledge as to gender expression. Hamilton is traveling through with these two men, like macho man, these men that are conforming to the societal expectation for men. So Hamilton can kind of model this behavior, right? Then Hamilton is just gaining money through this apprenticeship and eventually is like, psych, see y'all, I'm gonna go do my own thing as a mountebank of my own.
They're working mountebanker's hours.
Yes. Take two. Love it. The occupation of a mountebank has a lot of perks to it. The main being absolute crazy amount of freedom and mobility that it would give somebody. And especially in comparison to women. Women were not necessarily ever employed in professions that would allow them to travel very far and at their own discretion without the stigma. Of course, you had things like midwifery, which did allow you to travel, but certainly not across the country whenever you wanted. Mountebanks, the reason I think it worked so well for Hamilton and maybe for other people who were transing gender is it allowed you to keep a certain distance from people within a community, right? You would show up to a community, hang out there maybe for a few days, few weeks, whatever. You wouldn't necessarily get close to new people, close enough for them to suspect that you aren't who you say you are, I guess. And if they did, you would just leave. You would just go to the next town and do your own thing.
So they've got an opportunity to really define themselves.
Exactly,
yeah. Define the people they want to be around, define what they want to do and how they want to do it.
A female husband could go to a community, test out a new behavior. If it works, great. If it doesn't, you amend it and you keep going, right?
I mean, that's like the basis of every psychological study. Like,
exactly, yeah.
we're gonna, you know, isolate the independent variable and see what we got.
Eventually, after doing the mountebank thing, Hamilton eventually rents a room in the house of a Mary Creed in Wells, England.
All right, we're at Mary number two.
We are at Mary number two. And Mary Creed rented out rooms in order to earn some extra income, which was not uncommon at all. This income helped her care for her niece. Can you guess her first name?
Is it Mary?
Yeah.
Mary number three.
Yep. Mary Price.
Mary Price. Mary Price is rhymes with trice. Mary Price is number three.
Yes. So we have a Mary Hamilton, a Mary Creed.
That's Mama. Mary Creed is the landlady.
Yes. And a Mary Price.
Mary Price is landlady's niece.
Yes.
Price tries three. Got it.
Really only concern yourself with Mary Price. She's the important one in all
Mary
this.
Mary Creed, you're dead to me.
Well, one thing led to another, and Mary Price and Charles are getting along very well. They are increasingly getting closer, and we don't have a lot about this early time in their relationship, which, again, not uncommon. They probably saw no significance to be documenting their relationship at this point.
Sam, do you keep a diary? I don't keep a diary.
No, I don't.
There he is. I mean, I keep a record of my Wordle score every day, and that's as close as I get.
Yeah, we don't have any record of it.
But they were housemates. Oh my god, they were housemates.
And Mary Creed, the aunt, vetted Charles, and apparently it went hella well because Charles and her niece, Mary Price, got married. Hashtag married. Hashtag you may kiss the bride.
Yeah. And wait, so Mary Creed said it was, you, Mary, may marry my niece Mary, said Mary.
You need to keep that in because that hurt my brain and I need everybody to hear it. The way you said it, like you were differentiating them, loved it.
Because in my head I was, but in my mouth it was the same word.
But yes, Mary said Mary can marry. We don't know much about Mary Price and the circumstances of this marriage. It's very possible that Mary was like, this guy, hella cool. I am very charmed by Charles. I'm in love with Charles. And it's also possible that her aunt was like, girl, you're getting old, but you're going to be a spinster, right? Get married. So we aren't completely sure the circumstances, but I think it's important to keep all the possibilities in mind, really.
Hey, yeah. I mean, if I'm renting out rooms to keep my niece afloat, wouldn't I think it would be better that my niece had something that, you know, insured her some sort of financial stability outside of my business model? Yeah, as a risk-averse person, that is generally how I run my life.
Yeah, that's a great point, too.
The backup plan, baby.
That's a great point, too, because being a mountebank offered financial security. And although Charles didn't necessarily present Mary Price with an opportunity to move upward in class, which, as we know, is very, very difficult in mid-18th century England, they definitely offered Mary an opportunity for financial stability.
Get that bag, Mary. Get that bag, girl.
After they got married, they traveled the country as husband and wife. Hamilton continued to do their thing. To mountebank, selling ointments and advice.
I hate the word ointment.
Ointments.
O-I-N. Hate it. Hate it.
Ointments.
Lotions. Damn it.
Hamilton continued to sell lotions.
Thank you. Oh, it's so much better.
I will try my best to continue with lotion.
Wow, it's so interesting that somebody should be able to say, hey, I actually prefer that you know, use this word and
is it refreshing?
How about that? Society.
Better or worse than, like, moist?
Moist is fine.
I don't mind moist either.
No, I've been adjusted to that one for some time.
I feel like that was, like, the go-to.
Boing. It's that sound that
gotcha.
Just...
Gotcha. I feel similarly about the word prayer. I don't like the sound. Uh-huh. I don't like... It doesn't sit well. It doesn't make me, like, bleh.
It's very...
But I don't like saying it. Because I feel like I say it weird. Maybe it's a me thing. Maybe I'm projecting.
I feel like it's a TMJ inducer, if there ever was one.
I love hard-sounding words. Ignition.
Oh.
Well. Chiropractor.
Yeah.
I like words that sound...
Unvoiced consonant. So...
Yeah, not a fan.
It's beatbox sounds.
Ooh, I was right about to say...
Yeah. Anybody know that I was in an acapella group in college?
Now we do.
I was not the beatboxer. I was the music director. I played piano for rehearsals. But I can put with the best of them. And that is about it.
That was good.
And that's it. That's all I got.
Charles and Mary lived pretty happily for a few months, at least. From the sources we do have, they tell us that much. They were chilling. They were having a good time. But... Always a big but.
There's always a but.
A but with a capital B. Shortly after, you know, a few months into their marriage.
Honeymoon phase is over.
Yeah. Mary Price claimed that she was done with Charles.
Intriguing.
Very much so. Get this. Mary claimed that she just figured out that Hamilton was not actually a man. So while in Glastonbury with Hamilton, Mary marched right over to the authorities and filed a report. Thoughts?
So I'm guessing that maybe consummation was not necessarily involved early on.
What if I tell you they did have
conjugal relations,
intimacies?
Okay, so
Mary Price really goes through them in detail.
Okay.
They have penetrative sex.
Cool.
Yes. But let's put a pin in that for now. And we will definitely circle back, because right, what you've described...
So I'm suspicious, I'm confused, I'm...
As we all are.
Are we all? Yes, we are.
Because what you've described, what you've identified, is everybody's initial response, which is...
Ma'am?
Excuse me? Yeah, so Mary claimed that she did not know that her husband wasn't a man, even though she does confirm many times that they were sexually intimate.
I mean...
A number of times. Like, it wasn't just like, we're going to consummate our marriage. Like, they had good times, from what she describes.
I mean, if anybody's seen Bridgerton, and I'm guessing you have, I mean, it's not like Victorian women were well-educated ahead of time, you know, when it came to marriage, about this is what's going to happen, and it's going to be like this, and you will see that. Generally speaking, people know that there are biological characteristics that they could expect from a male body versus a female body. There are differences that they would expect and be at least aware of, if not familiar.
Yeah, I do want to emphasize that this is pre-Victorian. This is like 1740s. So you're definitely onto something in terms of what was she taught? We don't know. But...
I mean, this is when it's like, how to please your husband. Do whatever he says.
Literally, exactly.
That is basically the instruction manual. It's one sentence. Just do whatever he says.
Well, women, when they get married, were often regarded as, like, not fully educated. They were treated more like children, and their husband had to finish raising them.
Because they were their legal property.
Exactly. As you've mentioned, her story does leave her open to some criticisms here and there.
Yeah, I just have follow-up questions.
People typically fell into two camps when hearing her story. So one was what you described, which is...
If you've seen your husband naked, you might have figured it out earlier.
Yeah, like, people found it very astonishing that you could not know the sex of your lover.
I mean, here's the thing. Have sex with the lights off. Right? You're open to interpretation.
Nobody will be the wiser. People get really bogged down in the details of genitalia, basically.
Sure.
We'll get to that, though.
Which, I mean, calm down.
Yeah, so they basically were like, Mary's lying, obviously. Part two to that, the second camp people would often fall into was that some believed that Mary was telling the truth, and she was just ignorant of sexual matters. Mary was a young woman. People are like, that's completely plausible. This also gets into ideas of women being innocent and naive, and also kind of touches on the prevailing perception of lower class women, where the common rebuttal for that was like, yeah, but you know, she probably knows because she's poor, and that is equivalent to her being promiscuous or whatever, right?
The logic ain't logicking there, people.
So here's some logic for you. Whatever the case, Mary exposed herself to an immense amount of public retribution. So certainly she must have thought it was worth it, right? To get this marriage voided. She was like, I will do what it takes. So getting into the actual testimonies of it, Mary testified that she believed Charles to be a man, and then something changed. Don't know what that thing is, but she believed him to be a man until she didn't. She goes on in court to discuss their sexual intimacies, very detailed discussions of how Hamilton penetrated her, basically. But she describes that she did not suspect anything at this point. And she mentions, like, you know, I really liked Hamilton. But again, historians really get bogged down in the dirty details. Sex in the 18th century wasn't necessarily the same thing as now, and that's not to say, like, sex wasn't the same. Like, that certainly has remained the same for a very, very long time.
Reproduction. Yes. That's largely unchanged. Yeah.
But what is perceived as sex in other categories has definitely changed. So, like, they describe petting being equivalent to sex. The category has shifted a little bit.
Baseball had not been invented. They lacked the metaphor to talk about the bases, kids.
Exactly. So basically everything encapsulated sex.
Like, hey, did you go to Wrigley Field? Congratulations. Mm-hmm. You have consummated your marriage.
So yeah, when Mary talks about the fact that her and Hamilton had sex, that could be really anything that 18th century definitions of sex would entail.
Sure.
So it didn't necessarily have to be penetrative. That being said, she does talk about penetration a lot.
And generally speaking, if Mary were to be penetrated, she generally would know.
Yes, 100%.
Because that's how bodies work.
Yes, and sex toys existed in 18th century England. many, many sex toys existed. Like, that was not necessarily uncommon.
That is not new.
She not only knew that she was being penetrated, but apparently it was very good, which, as we've discussed...
Jeez, you don't have to brag.
In, you know, Making Sex by Thomas LaCour.
I will put that on the show notes begrudgingly, because I got beef with that book. But it's an interesting discussion starter.
Yes.
I'll toss that
definitely,
out
definitely, definitely.
Most definitely.
Brings up a lot of good themes. All of this to say that the female orgasm was very important to sex. It still is, but I mean in the way that people perceived reproduction and female health and just like sex in general, the female orgasm was at the pinnacle, right? Like,
yeah.
It was to be achieved.
Yeah, I mean, even in that book, LaCour argues that there, for much of human history, that conception demanded a female orgasm in order to take place. Millions of women everywhere would disagree with that. But there was a perception for much of history, he argues, that it was a necessary ingredient for that recipe.
Yeah, and without it, like, you were not having kids. Something important to mention is that, you know, typically when you think of marriage, you think of consummation within the historical context. And obviously, Mary makes it super, super clear it was consummated.
Right.
Many, many times.
Yeah.
But in the case of the Protestant church, consummation didn't really matter. It was more so about consent.
Okay, so we're both culturally Catholic.
Yes.
The fuck does that mean? I don't understand.
Question mark, question mark, question mark. If I were to take an educated guess, consent was the most important variable in validating a marriage in the Protestant church. If
not sexual consent, consent to the marriage.
Yes.
Okay, I got you.
So then the question becomes, Mary Price wants to void this marriage. Was there consent present? She believed that she was marrying a biological man.
And so she feels hoodwinked, led astray, because
yes.
She was not marrying a biological man.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore she says that she did not consent to marriage with that person because that person was not as they presented themselves on the wedding day.
Mm-hmm. And this theme of female husbands as this, like, immoral trickster is reoccurring throughout every possible rundown. Either way, stepping back from that, Hamilton sat in prison awaiting their trial for a month. I feel like it goes without saying, English prisons, nasty, with a capital N. Hella nasty.
Yeah, Janet Jackson would agree.
They were just gross. And Hamilton's being kept with other men who are being held there for a variety of other charges, but Hamilton is, like, considered to be, like, the worst one there, right? Yeah. You guys can't see Lauren's face, but puzzled.
It is contorted.
So again, the trial hasn't happened at this point. Hamilton's just being kept in prison. But Hamilton's deception was found to be unforgivable. The community of Glastonbury wanted to see Hamilton severely punished. They wanted to set an example that this deception, like, you can't come for our daughters, like, whatever.
I don't know. This could never happen again. Just fine.
But
thank you.
That was pretty good.
I'll
that
be
was
here
pretty
all
good.
Pod.
That was 10 out of 10.
Thank you.
The issue wasn't Hamilton presenting as a man. That's what's so important to reiterate. Cross-dressing happens. It has happened throughout history.
Sure.
The issue wasn't Hamilton presenting as a man or that they worked in an occupation that was reserved for men. I mean, sure, that made people uncomfortable, whatever, but
that wasn't the criminal act here.
Yeah, the issue the community had was that Hamilton married a woman and had penetrative sex. Apparently, sex that was so good that Mary Price couldn't tell that it wasn't a penis kind of thing.
They had lack of penis envy?
Oh my god, yes.
Oh my god, wait.
Oh my god.
Wait, oh my god, wait, no, it's because these biological men felt so threatened.
Precisely, threatened, that's the word.
They felt so threatened that perhaps women would want to have sex that they enjoyed and that they could do it without them,
mm-hmm.
that they were like, this cannot be allowed to continue.
That is
no
exactly
one will
what
marry
it is.
Us. And I mean, we've seen this theme continue. This is how we know sexuality is not a choice, because any woman alive today would be unlikely to actively choose to be attracted to a straight man. Look around, straight men. Question yourselves. We're already questioning you. You're just ignoring us. Join the conversation.
their ability to engage in sex with a woman as a man was the issue here.
God, I wish we just went Jurassic Park.
Right?
Life finds a way.
Again, Hamilton was cast as this immoral trickster, which, to a point, like, fair, because Mary Price didn't necessarily know the full extent of what she was getting herself into.
Fair. But also, like, their bedroom game was so good that everybody felt threatened by it. How about fucking sign up to take some lessons, you dumb fucks?
Girl, people still feel threatened by stuff like that.
I don't know. Read a self-help book.
What is it? The Kama Sutra?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Learn you a thing, okay? Like, literally ask women what they want. They'll probably tell you, because they've probably never been asked before. I don't know, think about that.
This is where it gets a little weird.
This is where it gets a little weird? Not me talking about people's lack of penis envy.
Touche, very good point. But this is where it gets weirder.
Fair.
Hamilton ends up being charged under the Vagrancy Act, (1744).
Thank you.
Yes,
Vagrancy Act different Vagrancy Act I was very
familiar
with. The
2022 one, yeah.
As I Google.
Fuck!
Sam, I don't even know what vagrancy is, straight up. Like, I've heard the word. I couldn't tell you what it means.
Yeah, I mean, it's important you mention that, because it is meant to be super vague.
It's very funny, actually, from a lexicographical standpoint, that vague is not a root word for vagrancy.
Oh my god, I didn't even realize that.
But
yeah.
It's vague.
There's a parallel there. The Vagrancy Act, historically, has been kind of used as a catch-all. It typically has focused on deception, employment, and some sort of transfer of money. The deception having to do with the employment, not just, like, general lying.
All right, but okay, I'm not a lawyer, but this man is self-employed.
Yeah, they definitely focused on the deception part of it, which however you want, I guess.
Like, there was a deception, but you're getting good sex. Let it go, girlfriend. My God.
So the Vagrancy Act, again, was kept intentionally vague to punish people who didn't necessarily fit into societal norms. And that's not to say, like, they always had the intention of using the Vagrancy Act that way, but it was definitely helpful in doing that.
Oh, I mean, it's like, you know, you can still get fined for being a public nuisance.
Yeah, I mean, you can get fined for, like, jaywalking.
I have a lot of feelings on that. And my feelings are, if I choose to cross the street where I choose to walk across the street, if I get hit by a car, that's my fault.
I'm taking that risk.
Watch me.
Courts wanted to ensure that Hamilton could never get away with living as a man, marrying their women in their community again. That was their number one thing. I can see Lauren rolling her eyes, and I agree.
Yeah, because, like, frankly, you all bought into it. It clearly didn't bother you.
Yeah, Hamilton was doing a great job.
Consider letting them live their life. My God, how does this... Oh, this doesn't involve you.
Yeah, so to one-up that, they wanted to publicly humiliate Hamilton. And they wanted to do this through public whippings. Like, they picked a period of time and they wanted to bring Hamilton through these, like, four other towns where they know that they visited as a mountebank and just basically, like, beat the shit out of them.
Wow, I have a lot of questions about jurisdiction. Basically, I know I'm 300 years late to this, but I don't think they can do that.
Well, apparently they can.
I don't think they legally could do that, and if they did, rewrite your damn laws, England.
The court just really wanted to send a message that other people who might transgender should not enter into any sort of legal agreement with another woman. And with that, Hamilton was sentenced to 6 months of hard labor and public whippings. And there are some illustrations of this that we will include in our show notes that depict the public whippings and just Charles Hamilton in general. This is where it gets even crazier.
Son of a bitch.
The story just keeps unfolding in such a strange way that I really am antsy to share it with you.
I need to Outlander and just slap some people.
This happened at the time of Outlander.
And funnily enough, like, I'm generally against punishing people with violence. I don't think the state should sanction violence against people, but I want to slap some people.
To pause on Outlander for a second, because that brings up a very excellent theme that I would like to touch on for a moment.
Hit me.
It taking place in, like, 1740s Scotland, where this is similarly happening. Charles Hamilton lived in Scotland at a time where, like, the Highlander form of dress was banned, right? No kilts and When dressed as a man, Hamilton chose to wear English clothes. So a lot of historians actually get into the weeds of perhaps Hamilton was making a political and cultural statement as well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, this is, the Union Act's pretty fresh here. This whole Scotland-England thing. We got some growing pains.
The story of Charles Hamilton wasn't even considered particularly extraordinary at the time it happened because female husbands existed. People, like, knew about them. Charles Hamilton was punished and people went on their way. But by the time the story reached the Atlantic, Hamilton all of a sudden had, like, 14 wives in these stories, which give it a whole other dimension. The Atlantic world in general becomes very interested in female husbands, as depicted by Charles Hamilton, that being a woman who presents as a man to marry another woman kind of situation.
Sure. Wait, so maybe some, like, you know, people who we would now define as lesbians were like, wait, you mean I don't have to marry a man and I can have sex with somebody who prioritizes my pleasure? Oh my goodness.
Very, very possible.
Let's talk more about that. Let's popularize that idea. Again, I'm very interested in that happening.
People were also just like, 14 wives? Oh my God. Polygamy.
Gandhi.
Yeah, so Charles Hamilton was the first person assigned female to marry a woman who was also described as a female husband.
Okay.
But the story doesn't end here, Lauren.
Lord God.
Obviously, everything that happened in Somerset in 1746 would have made it impossible for Hamilton to continue living there. I mean, they made it very clear.
They're a known figure.
Yeah, they don't want Hamilton there. The community has said absolutely not. So they set sail to Philadelphia in 1751. After a very long journey, their ship finally arrived in North Carolina in about January of 1752. I know, a little strange with the whole trajectory of that trip.
Some interesting trade winds there.
Yeah. From there, Hamilton made their journey north to Philadelphia.
You see him in the harbor now, see if you can spot him.
But
another immigrant coming up from North Carolina. His enemies destroyed his rep America. Welcome to him, Let's find out.
Loved that.
Thank you.
It wasn't until they reached Chester County, which is a suburb of Philly, that Hamilton was scrutinized. So traveling from North Carolina to Chester County to Philadelphia apparently presented no issues to Charles Hamilton. But again, once arriving, we see some issues arise.
Could I postulate that because Philly was the city of brotherly love, they felt threatened by a female husband?
Yes.
Somebody stop me.
But their reaction might surprise you. I will pause here for a moment to emphasize what this shows us. Specifically that people like Hamilton, who did transgender, didn't stop once they were punished, right? Like, Hamilton was punished pretty horrifically and said, okay, I'm just gonna go do it somewhere else.
I'm gonna speak my truth.
Exactly. So,
Republicans, if you're listening, it'd be really cool if you could just, like, stop trying to legislate hate. Like, guess what? Their marriage actually does not affect you.
Not at all.
Like, if you don't want your child to marry a female husband, that seems like a personal issue. Like, calm down.
Hamilton is mentioned in, like, a newspaper, basically in passing. Just being like, there's a Charles Hamilton here.
Red flag alert.
They were like, pretty sure this is a lady. And they kept it in the paper. Hamilton was detained in Chester County for a while, but they kept it in the paper to be like, does anybody know of a Charles Hamilton? Nobody responded. So
possibly because that's the biggest name I've ever heard,
right?
English speaking world.
Exactly.
Everybody's like, I know 7 Charles Hamiltons. You need to be a lot more specific.
So they let Charles Hamilton go.
Wow, my first decision I agree with.
They just continue to live their life. There was some things with somebody around sending a letter back being like, actually, I think that's my indentured servant, Sarah Knox, that ran away and is parading as a Charles Hamilton. But that's really, really unlikely. The way that Charles Hamilton is described in the newspaper, like the details that weren't made public during the trial and whatnot are mentioned. So we can take a pretty good educated guess that this was in fact Charles Hamilton. The last we hear about Charles Hamilton was in 1764, so about 12 years after reaching North Carolina, and they're wanted for stealing a horse.
Maybe they decided to freaking ride away from their problems and everybody judging them based on their name, and we're just like, right? You know what? I've actually had enough of this shit.
The weird part, not even weird, just kind of sad, is that, as if the story isn't terrifying. Sad enough, right?
Yeah.
Stealing a horse at this time is a capital punishment. Like, you will be executed for stealing a horse.
Felicity Merriman, if you're listening, that means you, baby girl, mm-hmm. 9-year-old, put that horse back.
Put Penny back, girl.
No independence for you.
Charles Hamilton steals a horse, which I feel like signals some sort of desperation. If you are willing to steal a horse at a time where that will literally get you killed,
you probably have something to ride away from, perhaps. Mm-hmm.
And again, we see Charles Hamilton in this number in the paper being described as, like, small, tiny hands. Like, features that have been commonly associated with Charles Hamilton up until this point. So again, historians make an educated guess that this is Charles Hamilton.
This is before, like, you know, forensic sketches, but there are characteristics that match the description.
Exactly. All and right. No follow-ups are mentioned in either story. We don't know the in-between. I think really the only people that know the in-between is Charles Hamilton.
Good for them.
Right? So that's the end of Charles Hamilton as the historical record knows them.
And they rode off into the night.
Oh, cute.
Maybe. We don't know.
Hopefully.
Nobody has any court records of capital punishment, and God knows they probably would have written that one down, so.
Yeah, I hope everything ended well for them. They went through quite a bit.
Yeah. Charles, if you're out there, good for you, boo-boo.
The story of Charles Hamilton definitely presents the wives of female husbands being tricked, right?
Yeah, there's a victim vibe there where definitely. They've been deceived, they've been hoodwinked.
They've been hurt, ultimately, because Mary Price describes being in love with, at least fond of, Charles Hamilton. So she's definitely not happy. But that isn't necessarily the case for all of the wives of female husbands. Intrigued?
I'm very intrigued, and I'm afraid to ask, but is it gonna get better or worse? The way that you said, and it trilled with a note of uncertainty. Oh, just lay it on me, Sam.
Yeah. So I will have to leave that decision up to you.
Fair enough.
So I thought we would quickly look at the lives of James Allen and Abigail Naylor.
Alrighty.
In the early 19th century, that's where we are, 1801 to 1810 kind of bracket, right?
Cool.
James Allen meets Abigail Naylor.
Mute cue moment.
Yes, while working in the service of Mr. Wood. Mr. Wood's not important. We don't care about him.
We don't talk about Mr. Wood.
Abigail was a housemaid and James was a groomsman. James was described as quite the dashing gentleman. They were described as very good looking, intelligent, very skilled at their job.
Not words people would use about me, but okay.
I'll use them about you. So James did not offer, again, any sort of upward mobility.
No, they're in similar working class.
Exactly. But James did present a safe choice for a woman of similarly limited economic prospects, right?
Sounds good. Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. So, you know, life is going good. James and Abigail get married in 1807 at St. Giles's Church in the Southwark Borough of London.
Fun fact, I actually have relatives who were also married at St. Giles's Church in the Southwark Borough of London, which is where the Globe Theatre is.
Ooh.
That's where Shakespeare bopped about. It's a cool place.
Life wasn't easy.
Yeah.
As you can imagine.
Germ theory hadn't, you know, really hit the mainstream
Racism,
yet.
Sexism. I mean, still today, right?
I mean, still people are not apparently understanding germ theory. We're going on year 2+ of the pandemic.
Real bad classism in 19th century England, as we've kind of touched on in the first episode as well. But the couple was definitely resourceful, and they took solace in one another. I mean, there are times where they had to work apart for a number of years, and they took steps to quit their jobs, start up a business, so they can spend more time together. That kind of thing.
Cute.
Right?
We love a supportive partnership.
Yeah. This is where it takes a turn.
I don't know.
After 21 years of marriage, their lives were destroyed. While working as a bottom sawyer for a shipwright.
The fuck is that?
In 1829.
Is that somebody who saws wood?
Shipbuilding.
Saws wood.
Yes, saws wood, shipbuilding.
Okay.
That sphere of work.
9. Rule number 17 of this podcast is you're going to learn about what
weird
jobs
professions
are.
Right? Yeah. Not even weird, just professions. Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to, you know, now you know what a cooper is. Now you know what a milliner is. Now you know what a bottom sawyer.
Uh-huh. Mountebank.
A mountebank.
Mm-hmm. So many.
So many.
Yeah.
Four.
Mm-hmm. Four in total.
Four in total. No, we know what the fairy doctor?
Oh, yeah, yeah, fairy doctor. I don't think that has a fun name, but fairy doctor, I think, is a fun name.
That's a very fun name.
So James is working as a bottom sawyer for a shipwright in 1829, living well, doing their thing, when James is killed by a falling piece of timber.
Ah, shit.
Yeah, right?
Did you think anybody yelled timber?
No, I think it happened too fast for that to happen.
So I think, it's going down.
So this piece of timber falls on James, kills them, I think, pretty instantly, but regardless, this is a very public death, by the way, right? James is chilling with all of their homies and dead.
It's a bit of blunt force trauma, isn't it?
In it. James was declared dead on the way to St. Thomas's Hospital, and the end of James's life is the beginning of Abigail's absolute fucking nightmare.
Oh, goody.
Because, for one, she lost her husband, who's also her primary earner.
Shit.
Yeah. And everyone learned that her husband was actually assigned female at birth. Like, now that is public fucking knowledge to everyone.
I would like to sue that coroner retroactively for a goddamn HIPAA violation.
You might want to wait on the coroner, because he is a character in this, and perhaps your opinion might change.
Want to bet?
I will continue.
All
right. So James's death is very public, right? And everybody who witnessed James's death comes to the hospital. They're all very worried about James. James, well-loved, right? People love James. They're doing their examination. That's the word I'm looking for.
They said, was it blunt force trauma?
Yeah.
In it?
Is there internal bleeding, mate?
In it, or not?
Bottle of water?
Bottle of water. Sorry, and do we know what date James died? Was it Tuesday?
Tuesday,
is
it?
Is it Tuesday?
Tuesday.
It's Tuesday, in it.
I can tell you it was 1829.
Fair enough.
You're going to have to live with that one.
I can live it. 1 in 7 chance.
We can pretend it's Tuesday.
We'll say, for the record, it's Tuesday, and the record is my own brain. If you're a professional historian citing this, don't.
Do not cite this.
That is not a fact. That is a conjecture based on the fact that I wanted to say the word Tuesday.
Tuesday.
Yes. We go to the hospital.
Yes, the hospital. We are currently at the hospital. Examination is happening, and they're like, what? Wait a minute. This person does not have a penis.
That is brand new information once again.
Right? So they're like, huh, head scratch. This is confusing because this person, actually, their wife is right here. So wait a second. Huh. To get to the coroner, what we were talking about earlier, with maybe your opinion of the coroner might change. Interestingly, the coroner would only refer to James by their male pronouns and refused to do otherwise because the coroner believed that James's marriage to a woman is what legitimized their male status. And that trumped anatomy, basically. But the coroner also marked James's body as being completely off limits to any further examination or dissection, which I'm sure, as you can imagine, was not necessarily a dignity one bestowed to very many people. This is the era of body snatching, right?
You're damn right.
And also definitely not a dignity that was reserved for people that often were outside of societal norms.
All right, coroner, let's see. Let's right? go allyship.
Coming through, snap, snap, snap.
Still a HIPAA violation. We should have had a close examination. Yeah. Everybody get the fuck out of that hospital room.
After everybody finds out that James is biologically a woman, people start questioning co-workers, which offers a really interesting historical perspective because you are getting people that aren't just, like, their wife. So all of their co-workers were like, I didn't actually think much of anything. I think two of them said something along the lines of, like, yeah, it crossed my mind, but James, cool dude. They often brought up the fact that the only real characteristics that kind of gave them any suspicion was James's voice and lack of facial hair. But apart from that, Oh, that and their masculine hands. That is talked about a lot. Apparently, James had some, like, hella big masculine hands. I don't know what that means.
If you're a ship worker,
right?
Congratulations. That's lucky.
I don't really know what masculine hands entail, but James had masculine. Them, right? But again, well loved by coworkers. A lot of them attributed any of their suspicions that they did have about James potentially, like, performing. They're just like, oh yeah, we just figured James was actually a hermaphrodite.
Do you know the origin of the word hermaphrodite?
I remember from Making Sex, but it's been a very long time. Fill me in.
I learned this when I was at the Louvre, mm-hmm. en France, because I was looking at a sculpture. It was just titled Hermaphrodite, and I thought, okay. And it was in a section about Greek antiquity. Hermaphrodite is a portmanteau, which those of you who have read Twilight know that a portmanteau is when you squeeze two words together, a la Renesmee. It's a portmanteau of Hermes and Aphrodite, as in this person has both the characteristics of Hermes and Aphrodite.
That's very interesting. And I feel like the correct term to use now is intersex,
correct.
Right?
Yes. Somebody whose chromosomes aren't strictly XX
or
XY.
Yes.
There are different variations that are well documented in medical history.
Yes, I just wanted to make that clear that they referred to James as potentially being a hermaphrodite, but the correct terminology that we would like to see used now is intersex.
Because we've moved past Greek mythology for defining people.
I would fucking hope so, Lauren.
God, amen to that.
Like Mary Price, what do you think Abigail claimed?
I do not know. Please leave me out of this.
That's pretty on the money. Like Mary Price, Abigail basically was just like, what? My husband? A woman? Huh?
I mean, here's the thing, though. I mean, if you're assuming that English brides, you know, were virginal, you know, upon their wedding day, so this is the only person they've had physical intimacy with, how the fuck are they supposed to know any differently?
Yeah, it gets into that whole conversation of if you're born a burning house, you don't know what it's like not burning or whatever.
I have no idea what phrase you're on, but I'm with you.
It's like if you're born into a burning house,
you don't know how it is to not have your house
like
on
the
fire.
Whole world is burning, like you know what I mean? Yeah. Like you perceive everything a certain way.
Sure.
Yes. So yeah, basically our girl Abby, she's like, yep, I was married to this person for 21 years, had no idea. Extremely common in every single female husband narrative where they marry a woman and eventually get caught. You always have the wife be like, I had no idea. Which makes sense, right? The social pressure to deny knowing that their spouse, deny knowing the biological sex of their spouse was strong.
Also, like, two can keep a secret if one of them's dead. Well, right? James got knocked out, so yeah. Abigail, take whatever narrative you can, girl. You've lost your primary, you know, earner in your household. Mm-hmm. I would also be keeping myself out of prison if I were Abigail.
Yeah. And that'll present issues for a little bit later, which we'll get into. But yeah, she's just wanting to put distance between her and any sort of like community culpability. Because community is very, very strong in the way that treatment of LGBTQ people is conducted.
And needless to say, believe women, not exactly the flagship narrative of 18th century England. Or 19th century England.
Yeah. And these denials definitely do go on to undermine aspects of the historical record. It definitely makes it harder for historians to parse through what people were actually thinking.
Sure.
But it is what it is. This is the reality of the situation.
It is what it is.
Mm-hmm. On one hand, female husbands getting married was very, very important in verifying and legitimizing, like, manhood, which it had been for a very, very long time before and a very long time after. But of course, this could also lead to really intense harassment for their wives if things were to unravel, which, I mean, you can assume that's what happened to Abigail and you would assume correct.
Yeah.
People were absolutely horrible to her. She was harassed endlessly.
And I mean, that's still something that happens, you know, if there are marriages that people perceive as, you know, I think, you know, common term now would be, you know, somebody who's a beard for somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
a lot of people needlessly insert themselves into other people's business and ask questions, but how could you not know? Motherfucker, maybe I did know, and maybe it's none of your GD business.
It's literally none of your business, yeah.
Somebody call Salt and Peppa and ask them to play None of Your Business.
People questioned her own gender and, you know, claimed that, like, maybe she had a penis, like, that whole thing.
Who cares?
They also were like, well, you must have known. That whole thing, right? Not, people are always concerned what people have in their pants, right? Mm.
And they should stop.
Hasn't changed.
They should stop.
So getting into the whole financial thing, right? We had talked about how at this point, James was the breadwinner. He was the prime earner for the family without a doubt.
James used to work on the dock.
Mm-hmm. Since Abigail's marriage was considered fraudulent, she was no longer entitled to any form of widow's payment.
Boo.
To make that worse, Abigail was repeatedly denied the insurance money that James paid for like 3 years that they were making payments on. Just like flat out, absolutely not denied. These companies, these clubs, I think they were called, they claimed like there was deception. Sorry, can't give you your money. And of course that was done to do like a public showing of we are making an example. We are signaling our contempt for you. I mean, I think Jen Mannion calls it an abusive rejection, right? Because that's what it was.
It's capitalism.
Yes, it was abusive. Abigail, at this point, couldn't even pay for James's funeral, let alone any of her own living expenses, both prior and after the funeral. She is just no money, right?
I'm angry. I'm angry on Abigail's behalf. I really am, because...
Me too.
This is gross.
Yes. She has absolutely nothing to her name. And eventually, with the help of the press, kind of, like, verifying her good character, confirming that, like, they did pay arrears, Abigail did eventually get the money she was entitled to.
Mm-hmm. Wow, J.G. Wentworth. Look at you. I know. Thank you. Thank you, English press. That's the only time you'll hear me say that on this podcast.
What I love about Abigail's story is that, well, for one, it's really sad. I don't love that aspect of it. I just mean to say that female husbands are often deemed central actors within the queer past, whether that be because historians are discussing them as lesbians or as an example of trans history. Like, they are always considered part of a queer past. But female wives are never typically discussed as participating in, you know, any sort of queer...
They're not seen as the main characters. They're seen as,
yeah,
you know, they're a plot point, if anything.
Exactly.
They're there at the altar.
They're always discussed as, you know, being deceived. But with people like Abigail, and there are many, many other female wives that go through similar life experiences, there's other stories where women and their female husbands, like, stick together through thick and thin, even after being found out. So I think there's more to be said about female wives, and they should have more dedicated to them. And I will say, Jen Mannion does make that historical intervention, and very, very beautifully, might I add. But, you know, female wives are never typically granted the same approach, just because that's how their lives have typically been written. They're never, I don't want to say complicit, because that's not the right word. They're not doing anything immoral.
People just, you know, historically, women have not been allowed to be main characters. Women have been their complements to the man.
Yeah.
And
maybe it's time to change that.
Marriage is a goddamn partnership. Mm-hmm. So things that can't be 50-50, we need to at least discuss the division of work here.
So that is the end to the stories of Charles Hamilton, James Allen, and Abigail Allen.
I will say, I do feel refreshed knowing that people did help and support Abigail.
Yeah.
Get that bag, queen, because you literally, like, y'all made payments. Y'all did. That is justice, baby. You did what you were supposed to do. People messed with you, and other people fixed it.
So, Lauren,
blessed.
Can I ask you a question?
Is it?
Who's your best of history? And, you know,
who's your pest?
Yep.
Oh, I'm red day. My pest, number one, is all of the goddamn, and I am aware that HIPAA is a law, it's, you know, a series of laws that only applies in the United States, and was frankly not, this is a complete anachronism, but all you HIPAA violators in this story can get fucked. And also everybody who went in, the people who suggested publicly whipping
Mm-hmm. Kindly, not uncommon for kind, any sort
I know,
of
but
thing,
kindly
yeah.
leave that shit alone.
I
think as a blanket statement, I think harassing people because you feel threatened by them, don't. I think harassing people, like, don't. I think that's as a blanket statement. If your other people's marriage does not, you know, affect you. So everybody who was a little bitch in the hospital room, you suck. Whoever was like, let's put this under the Vagrancy Act, you're my pest. People who were rude to Hamilton in prison while they were awaiting trial, you suck. People who didn't regulate the cleanliness and hygiene within English prisons, get fucked. I mean, stop being rude and icky to other people and, you know, maybe work towards being better and making other things better. Wow. I have a lot of feelings, and the feelings are generally in the vein of, I don't like it when people are mean to each other.
I know.
And I would like it if people who want to be married can be married.
I agree.
That's my thought.
Who's your best of history?
All right. Abigail, my persistent queen, Elizabeth Warren would stan me. I really appreciate, I mean, you have clearly endured a lot of hardship, Abigail, and I want to recognize that, I mean, people went on record stating that, Abigail, you've got great character, so I feel that I can back that up. Abigail, you're among the best today. And anybody who named their child a name other than Mary, frankly, that's
they win
just
the day.
You win. Congratulations.
That leaves us literally like three people.
Yep. Pick a
and
different,
one of them had two names.
Pick a different first name for your daughters. Yeah. Mm. Those are my thoughts. I would say people who fell in love and wanted to marry people they loved, congratulations. Congratulations to you.
This one's for you guys.
Mm. Pour some out. This one's for all the lovers out there.
I think I would give my best of history to the female orgasm.
Oh, I would like to retract my entire earlier statement and double down with Sam there.
I think we have to give it
Preach.
To the female orgasm.
Oh, I actually need to back my ass up too, because I would like to. My best of history is the word ointment.
We have many pests today, mm-hmm. many bests
today.
The
rats that infested English prisons. Gross. I'm over it. Well, Sam, this has been an excellent, if not equally depressing as last time, episode.
I don't think it's ever going to get happy, Lauren.
No, because here's the thing here, kids. The parts that people leave out of history are generally the parts that they don't want to talk about. And there's a human propensity towards avoiding uncomfortable subjects because we enjoy being comfortable. That's why leggings have become popular. So we'll leave it there for everybody today. And Sam, if people are looking for more information about female husbands or just want to learn more about the show in general, where can they find us?
Yeah, you guys can check out therestofhistorypod.weebly.com.
That's our website, and we've got all of our information as well as our merch. And you can find each of us on our individual Twitters. Mine is @Lauren_file. That's P-F-E-I-L.
And mine is @SM_Burnett.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of The Rest of History. And the rest
is history.